The second example is from a student of mine who was asked to write on a little 3x5 card why he took my course, which was titled Fantasy Makers and Truth Tellers at Northwestern. Being truthful, this course did not fit neatly, time-wise, into my schedule. Though, that is not to say that the time factor was the sole reason for my choosing of Fantasy Makers and Truth Tellers. I could have just as easily chosen federal tax policy, had taxation interested me in the slightest. Victorian writing is nearly totally unknown to me, and therefore this helped to finalize my decision. And finally, an example from the National Council of Teachers of English, who awarded their annual doublespeak award to the now inoperative Ron Ziegler. Ron Ziegler was asked whether a batch of Watergate tapes were still intact, and he responded with this single prize-winning sentence. I would feel that most of the conversations that took place in those areas of the White House that did have the recording system would, in almost their entirety, be in existence, but the special prosecutor, the court, and I think the American people are sufficiently familiar with the recording system to know where the recording devices existed, and to know the situation in terms of the recording process. But I feel, although the process has not been undertaken yet in preparation of the material to abide by the court decision, really, what the answer to that question is. Before we look at some of the cultural pressures and problems with language, I'd like to take a longer perspective. In 1842, Charles Dickens visited America, and he lived to tell about it in two books, American Notes, travel book, and a novel, Martin Chuzzlewit. Dickens was both amused and annoyed by American pride, and he said, "The national vanity swallows up all other countries on the face of the earth." Keep that comment in mind. He found that Americans fairly roared about their accomplishments, and that they took liberties with public truth, and that they exercised their freedom of speech by character assassination, libel, things like that, bragging about their accomplishments, and of course, always comparing themselves to the mother country and always coming out better. Dickens, being a Britisher, didn't really appreciate that very much. But anyway, in his novel, Martin Chuzzlewit, the hero, whose name is Martin Chuzzlewit, embarks on this adventure to America. And just as he's pulling up to the dock, he's greeted, as Dickens himself was greeted, by a wrangling mob of newspaper hawkers, crying out, "Here's this morning's New York sewer. Here's our New York stabber. Here's this morning's private listener." And out of the crowd, the foremost representative of the American press thrusts himself forward in greeting. "My name is Colonel Diver, sir. I am the editor of the New York Rowdy Journal. The New York Rowdy Journal, sir, is, as I expect you know, the organ of our aristocracy in this here country." "Oh, there is an aristocracy here then," asked Martin. "Of what is it composed?"
"Of intelligence, sir," replied the colonel. "Of intelligence and virtue, and of their necessary consequence in this republic, dollars, sir."
And so with the colonel walking along with his hand in his breast, like a man who was oppressed to inconvenience by a sense of his own greatness, they arrived at the Rowdy Journal's offices, and they hand Martin a paper, and he takes a look at it. And they ask him what he thinks. And he ventures to suggest that perhaps some of the letters in the paper are forged. The Colonel Diver doesn't deny that the press does it, and he calls the press the popular instructor. "And the popular instructed, what do they do?" asked Martin.
"Buy them," said the Colonel. "Buy them by the hundreds of thousands. We are smart people here, and we appreciate smartness."
"Is smartness American for forgery?" asked Martin.
"Well," said the Colonel, "I expect it's American for a good many things that you folks call by other names. But you can't help yourselves in Europe. We can."
Nearly every American that Martin Chuzzlewit meets cannot open his mouth without a blast of public bombast, as though there were no authentic private voices left in this country, and almost as though Americans had to stand on tiptoe and talk louder than anybody else in order to be heard. De Tocqueville noticed something similar when he visited America. Well, Dickens' critique is exaggerated, and I think that we have considerably toned our public voice down since the 19th century. But we still have more subtle kinds of problems. Oscar Wilde, in the 19th century, wrote a treatise called The Decay of Lying. It's not terribly well known, but in this treatise, he argues somewhat facetiously, but mostly seriously, against the rise of realism in art. And in this treatise, he decries the decline of the frank and fearless liar, who is serene in his disdain of proof of any kind. Well, today we have with us fewer liars like that than a more subtle kind of dishonesty or fakery. George Orwell had a word for it, called it doublespeak. And Arthur Herzog, in a new book, it's come out in the last couple of years, calls it more forthrightly the BS factor. Though this term put me off a little bit at first, I realized how tremendously accurate it is to describe a phenomenon of American language. It's a general term covering all sorts of fakery on the right and the left and in the middle in politics. You find it in pulpits, in the mouths of futurists and sexperts and talk show people and street talkers and school administrators and you name it. I think we're all in one way or another our own BS experts. Those of us who are students know that to survive very often you have to indulge in a little bit of that. Listen to what Herzog has to say about our decay of lying. Can you hear me in the back? Okay. America will be the first civilization to eliminate lies. Soon in America, the lie will be superfluous, unnecessary, and will be buried. The lie is not vanishing because it is being killed off like a hapless species of wildlife. The lie is a casualty of progress. For the liar, the outright lie has always presented an enormous peril, that of being exposed by reality. So clumsy and even hazardous a weapon as the lie cried out to be replaced by something that would accomplish the lie's objective and be at the same time safe. The new device that is making the lie obsolete can be called the fake factor, or, for those who require still more trenchant terminology, the BS factor. Now, a factor, which is a BS word, by the way, a factor makes or does something. Introduced into communications of any kind, this factor causes a subtle skewering of sense, logic, without ever becoming an actual lie. Unlike lies, which are occasional instruments used for specific purposes, to succeed, the fake factor must be ubiquitous. It must be used everywhere. And it must set the standard for what is or is not an acceptable level of truth. So it's brought about the lie which is not a lie and the truth which is not the truth. And increasingly, he concludes, it determines how our society talks to itself and the way it establishes meaning. I think that after a very discomforting era of Watergate and Vietnam, that we should realize by now that enormous political and military and economic power, coupled with fakery in language, is a very dangerous combination, and one which has also blackened our name in the courts of world opinion. According to Herzog, language is a way of adjusting to our environment and restoring our equilibrium. Now, with fakery and unreal language everywhere, the feeling of disequilibrium is constant as language becomes unhinged from reality. When I was reading that first piece, did you feel a little bit woozy, like you didn't know quite what was being said? I think that's what he means by disequilibrium. Let me give you an example of how language becomes unattached from reality. During the late 60s, we could watch our television sets and see the very gory and graphic pictures of the war. At the same time, accompanying those were some very vague and abstract words used to describe those realities. Words that were the words of our officials, our Pentagon people, our president, sometimes our own media people. Words like this,
troops were called advisors. We'd see something that looked mighty like a concentration camp, and it was called a relocation center. And we still have them, I guess, San Diego and other places. If the enemy was retreating, we were strategically withdrawing, you know, that kind of language. Dead human beings were called body counts. And in a ridiculous manner, a shovel during the Vietnam War was called a combat emplacement evacuator. George Orwell had a name for this kind of language in wartime. He called it the defense of the indefensible. When you have something you really can't defend, you can invent very fancy, very abstract words in order to escape that reality. And so we don't need to lie, although we do. We can simply concoct whole foreign policies out of this sort of language and create a fancy word of abstractions that's detached from the real world of politics and people. Of course, it's really not fair, I guess, to pick on a nation at war, because language really gets destroyed in a situation like that. There are too many things to hide. I think Watergate was really the watershed, or perhaps the waterfall, over which our illusions tumbled about truth in public places. Every day, a couple summers ago, we could watch on our television sets the daily charade of language manipulation. And we learned all the new techniques, all the ways we can evade really saying something, whether it's using passive voice or leaving out things, whatever it would be. And with the Watergate tapes themselves, it wasn't so much the bad grammar that was offensive, or even the expletives deleted, was the fact that the language was so vague and so detached from reality that you could hardly tell what they were talking about. Did anyone see the drama of the Watergate tapes that was on television a while back, a few weeks ago? It was absolutely terrible drama, because you could not understand what they were talking about. They had somebody, you know, looked like Nixon, and more or less. Somebody looked like Dean and Mitchell and all these guys sitting around in the Oval Office doing bits from the Watergate tapes. It was not funny. It was serious. But you really couldn't even follow it. It was so unhinged. And if it was bad drama, it was probably bad life, too, I suspect. My husband and I came out here last year after driving 2 days straight without stopping except for gas. And we plunged into the pool in Wenatchee, and we got out and dressed up and went into the motel bar and watched Nixon resign the day before we were to come up here. And Nixon, of course, delivered his fantasy statement on his responsibility in Watergate that night. He said, "I was wrong in not acting more decisively and forthrightly in dealing with Watergate." Do you remember that classic sentence? Forthrightly. I looked that up in the dictionary. That could mean honestly, or maybe it just means at once, you know, directly. And then dealing with Watergate. What could that mean? You know, we've all speculated. Does that mean stopping the suppression, or stopping the scandal, or keeping his cohorts from doing something? Who knows what dealing with means? Dealing with is an ominous, vague verb phrase that is coming into more and more use. The Missouri Synod it's being used, as in, this seminary board of control will deal with these erring professors. You know, when you say deal with, you avoid saying what kind of deal you're going to give out. Can you find places? Okay. As a writing teacher, I try to stress that writing is a discipline through which we can shape our ideas and kind of make discoveries about what our ideas are. And it's a very important discipline to sort them out, to figure out their logical relationships, to put them down on paper. For some of us, it's a way of making discoveries about ourselves. But writing fakery, as many of our students are encouraged to do, even encouraged and rewarded for doing it, is a very bad discipline and a very dangerous one, because when you write something down and give it verbal form, you give it an apparent substance, which the ideas themselves may not really have. In my
my writing classes, I also talk to my students about the fact that their language is not simply part of a spontaneous process, like budding trees. You know, language doesn't necessarily develop like that, or like soil erosion. It doesn't erode like that. Language habits, like Ziegler's and Nixon's and other people's, spread by imitation. And language is an instrument which we can shape for our own purposes. And of course, we take it for granted a lot of the time. We don't think about it very much, and that, for that reason, it's all the more insidious in its effects on us. And so I'd like to talk for a little while about some of the ways in which we shape our language. George Orwell wrote a classic essay called Politics in the English Language. And this was quite a while back. But he foresaw that the whole tendency of modern prose is away from concreteness. And I'm going to write this down up here as one of a list of problems in language we might keep in mind. Concreteness and abstraction. Now that could mean partly that people don't like to give proof, don't like to back up their statements with facts. We're all familiar with the salesman who is throwing out generalities and never really telling you about his products, you know. Or the preacher sometimes who has glorious, wonderful abstractions but never really gets down to cases and you wonder how you can ever apply it. Or those of us who are teachers are familiar with the student who writes one vague generalization after another and never really gives any evidence. Well, that's one problem with concreteness, but another one has to do with the choices of words. And we can choose words deliberately, especially when we're writing. My students will come to my class and think that in order for language to be really concrete, they have to have a lot of adjectives, you know? And I'll give them a poem that I've rewritten and made really bland, and I'll say, okay, liven this up, give it some flesh and blood, and they'll add a whole lot of adjectives. And they forget about verbs. What Orwell noticed was that we are constantly turning verbs, action words, into noun phrases and verb phrases and abstractions. For instance, we'll say something like this. We'll say, I would like to make inquiry regarding such and such, instead of saying, I would like to know, or I ask. Instead of using, you know, the verb ask or inquire, we're saying inquiry. We're making inquiry regarding, we're adding words, we're padding. I open my Northwestern alumni report, and I find this sentence. It's not horribly bad, you know what the writer means, but it's sort of up here in some kind of abstract realm rather than saying something directly. The sentence goes like this. We are making headway toward the goal of assuring the publication's future via increased subscriptions. Now that has one, you know, abstraction after another. For instance, via increased subscriptions. Well, you could take a sentence, a phrase like that, you might use it in your work. And instead of that, why not say by increasing subscriptions, turning the noun into a verb. Another example is when we say something like this comes into conflict with that. You know, instead of saying these two things conflict, using the verb, we tone down the conflict. We tend to create kind of an abstract world of words when we avoid verbs, just simple direct verbs. And you can probably increase your own impact in your communicating using verbs better. Another kind of problem that has to do with unreality and dishonesty in speech is wordiness and redundancy. We all need standards of value in order to find ways of exposing things that are not of value, but in our society it's harder and harder to find standards of value in people's speech because our officials, our bureaucrats, our government, people in business and so on are continually being wordy and not saying a whole lot. For instance,
Dorsey, a vice president of Northwestern University, sends out this communication in the campus mail. He's writing about the energy crisis. He says, all thermostats are in the process of being reduced in order to maintain 68 degrees in the area of the thermostat. And you take a sentence like that and you wonder what is on the man's mind. Does his ego require that many words or what? And think of all the paper that's wasted, all the memos that read like that. The problem is that as we conserve heat and other kinds of energy, we squander our verbal energy. But, you know, squandering, I think, is a national habit. We do everything on a big scale here in America. Besides these problems, there is the problem of non sequitur. And, of course, there are lots of logical things that I could talk about. This is the only one I mentioned. Now, there was a non sequitur, or a statement that does not follow, in the student example that I read. He said, Victorian writing is nearly unknown to me, and therefore this helped finalize my decision. You know, the second does not follow from the first at all. But putting in the word therefore makes it kind of sound important, you know, and sound sort of like a college person would say. Well, you know, I can't pick on students at all because other people do it. There can be such things, and this is really insidious, as hidden non sequiturs, where the words of logic like therefore are not even put in at all, but the person is making an argument nonetheless. For example, this is from a book which some of you may recognize as saying some good things, but it's making a faulty argument, at least in a faulty way. The book is called Living on the Earth, and the whole book is written in lowercase letters. When we depend less on industrially produced consumer goods, we can live in quiet places. Our bodies become vigorous. We discover the serenity of living with the rhythms of the earth. We cease oppressing one another. Did anyone hear the non sequitur in there? The problem is that, of course, ceasing to oppress one another does not necessarily follow from living in nature. And one of the rhythms of nature is violence. And we sometimes get so caught up in what Herzog calls image words, you know, some of the popular ideas connected with nature that are really trivializations of what living close to the earth could be, that we find ourselves being trapped into nodding our heads when we hear something like this, rather than thinking more critically about it. Besides these various things, there's the all-purpose statement. I have an all-purpose speech. That I will not read to you because it's so incredibly boring. It's full of, you know, one cliche after another, but you could give it on any occasion whatsoever. And Art Buchwald has written an all-purpose press release for the State Department. You just fill in the name of the colonel who overthrew, you know, through which democratic leader in which country and how we're supporting him and so on. I brace myself every time I open the mail. I used to work at Northwestern, and I'll be working part-time teaching at Mundelein College in Chicago, so I'll continue to get this kind of mail, I'm sure. But I also open the mail at the Christian Century, and we get all kinds of things there. And I brace myself for the BS factor. For instance, I unfolded a church newspaper one time and was delighted to see a picture of a friend of mine on the front page, somebody I hadn't seen in a long time. And she had been elected president of a women's organization. So I wanted to read on and find out what Barbara was going to be doing in this new job. And this is what I found. To discover new directions for UUWS and to influence all women by being receptacles and disseminators of the entire organization's strengths, needs, aims, and diversities is a priority item. When you overload the circuits of a sentence like that, the meaning shorts up. Doesn't mean anything. In my classes, I welcome my students to bring me examples, you know, of various kinds of BS factor they encounter. And they come up with questions like these. Is curriculum revision merely a reshuffling of the old cards and not revision really at all? You know, a few cute new names for the English courses, but it's the same old, you know, romantic list and so on. Is the student center at the edge of campus life? Does tenure protect the freedom of speech of teachers who don't allow their students freedom of expression? Maybe that's downright hypocritical language right there. Are rest homes places of rest? Are they places to die? Does Social Security at the present rates provide security? I stood 2 weeks ago in a grocery line behind two elderly ladies who were cashing their checks, and one of them had a check for $121. And I wondered how far that would really go in that grocery, in that neighborhood in Chicago. I don't think it would be very secure. Well, BS, if I may be so bold as to use that word, covers a multitude of sins, and very often it fattens up lean thoughts, and there we get into pretentious language, and all of us do this sometimes. I'm sure I do it too. For instance, I once gave my students an editorial on tenure that was published in the University of Chicago student newspaper, The Maroon, and this article on tenure was 8 inches long, with wide columns. My students slashed it down to 4 sentences. And I won't read it to you either, because it was extremely boring and repetitive. But we do it too. We teachers do it too. We say things like, it is not an unjustifiable assumption that, da-da-da-da. We don't have to use all that language, but we do. Or, in order to keep our sentences from coming down with a bump, as George Orwell would say, we'll say something like, this is a factor which we should do well to bear in mind. Those kinds of what Orwell calls them is aspirins at one's elbow. One can always use them, no matter what one is saying. I think we tempt our students, particularly in colleges, to be dishonest when we ask them to write for and do their work for nobody. They have no audience. In many learning situations, the whole thing is very isolated from real life, and so their language gets isolated from real life. George Orwell says that there are two important ways we can help to avoid fakery in our speech. One is to keep in mind the very real flesh and blood things that we really are talking about. And the other is to imagine an audience, a real flesh and blood audience that you're talking to. I think that a lot of our failures to communicate have to do with failures of our humanity to one another. It isn't just a matter of style. And all of that is made worse by the fact that we live in a very depersonalized society. Last November, I got a letter, one of many. I have been applying for an academic teaching job for several years and have written hundreds and gotten hundreds back. And this letter was from a college that had advertised an opening in my field. Now, those are the colleges that always write back saying, dear applicant, we're sorry we don't have an opening in your field, and so on and so on. But this one was special. This was a special letter, and I'll read it to you. It starts out, dear applicant, the hundreds of letters of application I have received do not permit me to respond personally to each applicant. Sounds like he's going to snap me up. Well, it's okay because you understand after you do this for several years that these people would go broke if they wrote personal letters back to each of the 500 people who responded to an opening, you know, one opening. So they have to use their ditto machines and whatnot. But he goes on. This is what he says. Although many angels may dance comfortably on the head of a pin, only one professor can comfortably fill a single teaching slot. Despite your special qualifications and valuable achievements, therefore, I cannot hold out to you any hope that you'll be offered a position at our college. Thank you for applying. Best wishes in your search for an academic Eden. You know, that's what Dickens called the national vanity, you know, just preening and clever, that kind of remark. And what's more, it's the sort of thing that has no audience before it. Say nothing of the non sequitur, if anyone heard it. Charles Dickens has lots of wonderful characters in high society who don't see their audiences. And many of these characters, you know, they're always dropping their monocles or they're closing their eyes and whatnot. But he has a character named Mrs. Myrtle, in one of his novels, who addresses one of her friends in her parlor this way. She says, "It is quite unnecessary to say to a person of your good sense, wide range of experience, and cultivated feeling," said Mrs. Myrtle from a nest of crimson and gold, and there put up her glass to refresh her memory as to whom she was addressing. And I'm also reminded of T.S. Eliot's character, J. Alfred Prufrock, who fears the eyes that fix you in the formulated phrase. How many of us have heard formulated phrases turning us into things right in front of another person? Clerks will say it, telephone operators, insurance companies. "We're sorry to report that your insurance does not cover such and such." You know, that kind of thing. And teachers and pastors from the pulpits using formulated phrases, how it turns us into dehuman things. Another way that we use language to not communicate is to overindulge in jargon. Another way that we use language to not communicate is to overindulge in jargon. One of my most exciting times in my life was as an undergraduate at Valparaiso, when I was learning the jargon of the political science trade. And I felt it was very exciting. You know, I was learning this secret slang, this argot of this underground organization and all these new words and phrases. And you felt important, like you were really learning how to do it, you know, like the big time people do it. And we even translated the Lord's Prayer once into political science jargon. We really had a good time. And we'd gum together these phrases, we'd take notes, you know, in class, and we'd reshuffle all the words, make a paper out of it. We get an A in our paper. We were rewarded for this. Well, I look back on that, and I'm rather appalled, but I do think that we need jargon. We need special words in our professions, words for new discoveries, and certain concepts that we can't put into other words. But I think it's real important that we not overuse it, because if we do, we will never allow interdisciplinary communication to happen, and we will continue to intimidate people who are not experts like we are. I think we should ask ourselves always two questions. What do I really mean? And secondly, is there a simpler way to say it? Now, I'm not talking about writing in a literary manner, although some of our very best literary writers are very simple writers. There's one more kind of category, I guess, that I would like to talk about briefly, and then we can have some discussion, and that is advertising language. Now, we're so bombarded with this that I don't have to give you a single example, but I would like to read to you a little bit from Lewis Carroll's Looking Glass to give you an idea of the form that advertising nonsense takes. This is between the Queen and Alice. "I'm sure I'll take you with pleasure," the Queen said. "Tuppence a week and jam every other day." Alice couldn't help laughing as she said, "I don't want you to hire me, and I don't care for jam."
"It's very good jam."
"Well, I don't want any today at any rate."
"You couldn't have it if you did want it," the Queen said. "The rule is,
jam tomorrow and jam yesterday, but never jam today.
It must come sometimes to jam today, Alice objected.
No, no, it can't. It's jam every other day. Today isn't every other day, you know.
Well, as Alice says, it's dreadfully confusing. And as we become more confused and foggy and detached from reality, we reach for the jam or the flip-top box or whatever it is. What the BS factor does is to divert our attention from real content so that we pick up other messages. I often assign my student's presidential speech listening, or maybe he's having a press conference. Doesn't matter which president it is. And they will watch it, and they'll come back the next day, and they don't know what he said. They couldn't tell me for anything, and I couldn't tell them, because the whole seems like the whole manner of speaking is one to divert your attention from really thinking at all. And so you pick up other messages, like the president is forcefully moving ahead, or something like that. It comes through in his body language and some other things, but not in his content. Presidential speeches have a lot in common with advertising in that sense. I'd like to close and then ask you for some examples of your own by reading you a poem by the Russian poet Yevtushenko. And it's a lovely poem, not only because of what it says to teachers and to students and to all those people who shape our world and the language in it, but also because it's a very clear, direct, well-written poem. The title of it is Lies. Telling lies to the young is wrong. Proving to them that lies are true is wrong. The young know what you mean. The young are people. Tell them the difficulties can't be counted. And let them see not only what will be, but see with clarity these present times. Say obstacles exist they must encounter. Sorrow happens. Hardship happens. Forgive no error you recognize. It will repeat itself, increase. And afterwards, our pupils will not forgive in us what we forgave. Do you have some ideas or reactions to this, or perhaps examples from where you've come from, or maybe you've got some ideas about what kinds of cultural pressures there are that are producing problems in our language?
Jim, you talked about how the truth can be so detached from reality that it can be a lie. And can we make it, here I am doing a new speech for double talk itself. Can a lie be so close and so appropriate as to be the truth?
Can you give an example of what that would be like?
Okay, well, let's say, and maybe it doesn't relate to your subject, but let's say, is there a time when the person that wants an answer from you does not deserve the truth, or it doesn't depend on whether they have the right to ask you the question, let's say. Do I have to bother you with that?
I think that sounds like more of an ethical question than something that has to do with language, although we are, you know, what we're talking about does involve an ethical issue. But I don't know. I suppose there would be plenty of situations in which you might not want to tell the brutal truth. We all did that. Probably all hate each other and couldn't live together.
Oh, yeah, let me put that another way. You're getting on it now. I think you're helping me to say it right. Well, I think what you've shown me is that truth isn't sometimes as cut and dry as we think.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that the straight truth, can that be also a lie? Can that be far from the truth? I mean, is language that malleable?
Or it's so limited that it can't express everything that is the truth. You can only say part of it. Yeah,
speakers?
Language implies community. That is, that for everything that is said, it is said because there is someone out there. Most of the time we treat it as a vague something, but nevertheless, if there was nothing out there, we wouldn't share. Language is kind of sharing. I wonder how much of language is dependent then upon good listening.
And good observing and sensing too?
Yeah, that all kinds of things are supposed to happen at the other end, which is intended, you know, if you could, I know that for everything that I say, there are probably 2 dozen better ways to have said it, but I'm still constantly amazed at the people that repeat what it is I say, and I can't for the life of me recognize it.
Yeah. It's certainly true in Missouri Synod right now.
Right. That you not only can talk past each other, but you can also be listening past each
mm-hmm.
other.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, is that part of language, is the receptor?
I think we do some of these things and others that I didn't go into in order to prevent listening, to prevent being heard, really. At least to prevent our content being heard.
Mm-hmm. How do you classify the language of an Eric Severide?
I don't know. Do you have some thoughts about Eric Severide?
I'm interested in what you have to say.
Well, I'm not that much of a media watcher that I've got all these different people figured out, you know.
Okay, what do you know about this?
Well,
we talk about words.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a guy, you know, that really does use language as a weapon to intimidate people. Certainly, he's capable of some very subtle distinctions, and he can use it very well. But he uses it as an instrument of power over many of his speakers, especially if he doesn't like them. Or he'll waffle a lot. If he looks bad, he'll waffle in a very elegant way.
Yeah.
William F. Buckley. There was another hand back here.
That's hard to put down.
I have a question. What do you mean by he'll waffle a lot?
Yeah.
Someone will say, make a statement that he doesn't agree with, and he will begin to disagree with it and then realize he's wrong and elegantly slide away from answering the problem.
And why did he say waffle?
Because someone came up to me tonight and asked me to denounce slang. I decided not to. Oh, sorry.
Could you give me a couple of examples of formulated phrase is used by a pastor?
Wow. Give me any sermon, any book. It's amazing. I was at the Anaheim Convention, and it was amazing how these pastoral delegates could get up and spin off a 3-minute, that's all they were allowed, a 3-minute spiel. Pasting one phrase onto another, brothers and sisters in Christ. You know, now that we've got the sisters in there, it's an even longer phrase. It takes up a little more time, a lot of the phrases in the hymn book or biblical phrases that are overused are constantly put in there, and they become trivialized by being repeated too much. I think in creating new words, we kind of get new slants on ideas, and that's one of the reasons that. A good sermon has a couple of phraseologies that catch your attention. Yeah.
Yeah. Two areas I'd like to know if you deal with your students. That sometimes you do want to talk about concepts that aren't concrete,
correct.
That are very fuzzy, and they're very, very difficult to talk about. And particularly if they're new concepts. And one of the frustrations I have sometimes, a student will try to cut down on the words so much that they miss what's there. How do you help students to do that?
What field is this in?
Well, I'm in environmental research. And I I know quite a few people have this problem. They'll be doing a theoretical problem. They're trying to present it, a new way of looking at something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not precise, but it's very important. The question of ethics, for example, would be an area where sometimes you can't be very precise. But yet, you don't want to have a lot of BS in there. You don't want to try to fool people. And you really are struggling, or I'm really struggling, or the people I work with are really struggling to get a concept across that is fuzzy, because that's the nature of the concept.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you write about that? It's a frustration I have. It's really hard.
I think that vague language can be extremely useful at the kind of creative stage of thinking, especially. Also, I'm certainly not talking against abstractions. Very often we can get get less abstract than we are, though. Go down the abstraction ladder a little ways towards something more concrete. But one way you can do that with new ideas is to use metaphors and images that are concrete that you can make comparisons with.
And then you, of course, have to know the community that you're talking to so that those metaphors mean the same thing. And then, however, if you're trying to give that community a new concept, it makes it even harder because sometimes the metaphors don't fit quite as well. And sometimes all you can do is tell stories, and they sort of get the feel of it.
It's humbling and yet sometimes useful to check back, you know, and have them give it to you back and see how it's coming out or getting processed in those heads out there.
Because there are concepts that are new, fuzzy, and very important that you have to work both at listening and at talking very hard to get.
Mm-hmm.
If you pick up a philosophy and read them, sometimes it's very hard, but yet there's something there.
You can also help to kind of find the shape of the thought, feeling in the dark or whatever, by contrasting it, saying it's not this, it's not that,
right.
Things that they are familiar with,
right.
To help them find out what it is.
In the other major countries, do they have the same problem we have here, getting answers to the questions? Are the politicians more honest? Are the ads more honest? Do they say what they want? Or are they pretty much the same? I got the impression when you started that we talked about the problems we have in this country.
Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, Orwell was writing about Great Britain, and other people have written about British language, too, and Dickens makes a lot of fun of British BS in the 19th century. But I don't know a lot about it. I haven't traveled all over the world or anything like that. I suspect there are people here who could add something. But I wouldn't be surprised if that's very true. I would think there'd be a lot of bureaucratic language in some of the communist countries, for example. I'd think that our advertising probably dominates world advertising, I would guess. And so a lot of the same things are going to be picked up in other countries. But there is something about America. You know, that's really kind of insidious. Our bigness, I don't know exactly what it is, that makes us exaggerate, makes us wanting to keep reaching beyond the finite limits that we have.
Don't we, I feel that that as children even, we're programmed to use wordiness, though, when kids are asked to write 100 words on something, whether they know 100 words or not about something. They're asked to write 100 words as though they fill in with superfluous words.
I struggle with that too, because I think it's important to give a limit and say, okay, you've got to write within these limits. Now you can do whatever you want, but do it within 100 words. And you can do that, and you don't have to tempt them to be dishonest if you get them to, you know, give them ways of filling it out. Give them some techniques and some things to do with that space. Instead of just saying, you know, do it, here's your subject, go to it. And helping them to avoid certain kinds of wordiness. Although I always have students who write something and they'll say, I couldn't write anymore. And if what they say is right on target, it's very concrete, you know, as well as maybe original or it's not just a lot of vague generalizations. That's fine, then, you know, for sure. I'm not a stickler on that. But we do encourage BS in our schools by a lot of the kinds of assignments that we give.
Sometimes the assignments, we do it in art, in visual art. And Jack was talking to me the other day about how he does it in poetry. if you take a very simple concept like yellow, and just have a student write 100 words on that one word, pretty soon they find out that the very simplest way is probably the most direct and easiest understood, instead of making an assignment to just simply write 20 pages on some particular thing, but to start with a word that means almost all it can mean and does it as well as 20 pages would do, you can really get an appreciation for the simple.
Is this condition you describe a relatively recent phenomena, or did it exist before, or is it just something we've just identified now and existed before and now, but we just didn't, weren't aware of it?
Does anybody else have any ideas about that?
There's an excellent article in the current issue of Time magazine on many of the points he addressed on language and the poverty of language in the United States today. And as I said, the article makes many of the points you made. It also stresses the importance of television on our culture and how it has affected our language. And the article ends with a kind of certain statistic for me that 30 years ago, high school graduates were able to define something like 473 words on the average. And today, the average is something like 420. So in 30 years, it's been a decline.
I think most of our communication that we have is all monologue. So you can't stand up and say, well, I disagree on that, or I don't know what you're saying, or that doesn't make any sense. And I think we also, in terms of status, the ministers do this, you know, with a collar and stuff, and the military does this with all the medals. They create an image that's almost a barrier for someone to say BS. So then they get away with it.
Can't stand up in a faculty meeting and do that.
Well, you're not so, you can.
You can, but you may not even
you won't make dean.
Edward Newman has a book out now, too, Plain Speaking, I think, that's been on the bestseller list for several months. Edward Newman, news commentator.
Yeah, he says that certain words run the course. For instance, viable.
And of course, relevance is one of those. It's no longer relevant.
I have a 1980 Sears catalog, which of course is recent. And if you read the ads in there, you think it came out of a comic book.
Really?
Because these just aren't relevant. They don't, you know that they can't possibly do, especially the medical things that they sell. They can't possibly do what they're supposed to do. And so when I read an ad today compared to what they did in 1980, I think they're a lot more honest than they were yesterday.
You know, for the timeliness of our language right now, I think we've gotten to the point where we're reacting against BS in a way that's limiting. And this might also be a partial answer to your question about pastors' formulated phrases. I think that we've gotten enough afraid of BS, especially people who are somewhat educated, have gone to school and school and school, that we try to qualify everything that we say. At least we think that we can qualify every idea that we have in some way. And so often, we cannot do it carefully, and so we simply generally qualify it by saying very general terms that are like sort of, kind of, possibly, probably, I think, not I believe.
In some sense.
Right.
In some
sense. Things like that. All of those are attempts to qualify that are extremely uncareful. But we continue to do it.
That we really don't have a vocabulary that we are comfortable with.
I think our discomfort in the technological world could have a lot to do with our problems in our language. And one of the things that struck me was that with the specialized vocabularies, and to some extent you live in your language as a kind of a skin, it's not just a tool that you use because it comes out of you, you know, that our work is more and more far away from our lives, too. Yes.
I've been kind of listening to this, or the people listening, and that's the message that comes through. Everybody feels impoverished because they're not eloquent. Mm-hmm. And yet, how eloquent is simplicity, right? Mm-hmm. There's a little bit called elements of style, but the element is simplicity. And listening to Dr. Benton reply to some questions, he's very elegant because he's succinct. Mm-hmm. He's just, there's nothing more to say. It's true, and yet it's true.
You started out by saying the lie was passé or fast becoming passé because the BS factor was coming into being or recognizing it. Does this imply that the BS factor is a deliberate mistruth or a lie? I think there is a problem here, you know, vagueness that we all indulge in. It seemed to come out that maybe that was in politics, advertising perhaps is mm-hmm. true, but I wonder if we can say that it's always, you know, a lie. You don't have to tell a lie because you can be vague.
I think there are a whole range of degrees in which you choose or do not choose something like that. Language doesn't come singly in single units. It comes as a whole bunch of things, whether we'd be using English teacher language or preacher language or whatever it might be. And you kind of choose to embrace maybe a certain, the coin of a certain group at least. And so like, you know, can you blame the people at the National Council of Churches for talking the way they do? I get mail from them all the time, and I don't even read it anymore. I just put it in my BS folder. It's so difficult to understand. So much in-groupy stuff, and everything is, you know, UUWF. Everything is these abbreviated phrases like that. And I don't know, do they choose to talk the way they do?
Some of them are beyond their means. I mean, you know, they're afraid. They're supposed to address all these big issues and they don't know that much. That's really, in the environmental area, I spent about 10 years doing research in that area. And if you think that there's somebody up top that knows what they're doing, there isn't. They really aren't.
Nobody's got the guts to say, I don't know.
Yeah.
So they...
That's right. And they can't say, well, I really don't know about that, and I'll see if I can find out the answer. That's not only, we don't accept that. Can you picture a presidential candidate doing that? I mean, they crucify him. So he BS's. That's the old...
Yeah, but isn't that what lies behind that? When a person doesn't want to answer, he will use the BS factor of a lot of English language and say nothing. He doesn't answer yes or no, I don't know. And I think this is what's coming out of government when they don't want to answer anything, but they're expected to say something from Nixon and even Ford and the others. They say things because it's expected of them. But they don't want to tell you a straight story or the answer, because either they're not ready to or they don't know.
You find this in science, you find this in technology, education, all of it.
Same thing.
I could read you some examples from his book. He makes fun of psychiatrists' lingo, and I think maybe TA is more full of that than any other bunch, but although they have some useful concepts too, but this isn't TA language, this is just kind of some general terms. A psychotic, a person who understands his own reality. A neurotic, a person who thinks your version of his reality is the appropriate one. Rigid, being set in ways which get in other people's way. Flexible, not being set in your ways because you don't have an idea of what a way is in the first place. A patient, a human being who is really, just between you and me, a total loss. A psychiatrist, a man whose profits depend upon the maintenance of a total loss. A psychologist, a man who is at a loss defining what is a total loss. And so on. He goes through about 50 different kinds of BS type of language until you feel like there's no room left, you know, to say anything. You don't want to open your mouth. I hesitate to even talk on this subject because I have to do it in words. First chapter is called Americant. He suggests in his very first chapter, and he's not a communist or anything, but
He suggests we don't use the word America anymore because it has a ring to it that people are always using it. America, America, this and that. He thinks we ought to use United States because it's harder to say and then people won't say it so often. But his second chapter is called Americant. It's spelled with a K, and he makes fun of all the people who are putting K's in America and Crispies and all kinds of other words. K's in them. And then in the third chapter, he attacks anarchlings. In the fourth, this is alphabetical, you notice, anything authorities. And then the next, apocalypse, big timing, candercon, counterculturalism, credentialism, culture cant. Probably there he's talking about art critics and people like that. Deus ex computer, that looks interesting. Executalk, that's a nice one. It gives you the impression that people want to become executives so that they can, you know, take the executive's flight on the airplane and use their execu cards and be in the execu suite and so on. Sad think, gut speak, he goes on and on. News think. Upbeat endings in news he talks about, problems. His last chapter is called Verbicide, and when you get to that point, you really don't know what you can even say anymore. Well, it's 5 till. I think maybe we could break and kind of get ready to go over there to chapter 2.